Myths, Monsters and Murder, an Institutional History Society Halloween special. Not all myths are make-believe, nor all beasts invented. Some monsters were real, living, breathing men and women. For every story of spectral figures, of bloody encounters in the night, there can be found scraps of truth amid the bare bones of an inflated, bloated tale. Monsters have coexisted with humanity since first we set foot on this earth, living at the periphery of our minds, at the edges of the unknown.
There, reality and imagination blends and gives birth to aberrations of the unexplained.
40,000 years is a long time to live in fear, but that is the date of the oldest depiction of a monster in prehistory.
The Lurenmensch figurine, or Lion Man of the Holsteinstadtl. It's the oldest known zoomorphic figure.
That's an animal-human hybrid, dating to between 35 to 40,000 years old. Standing bolt upright, this figure carved from mammoth ivory stares sightlessly from sunken eyes, implacable, unspeaking. Was it an offering to a god, a deterrent to other, scarier monsters, or a depiction of an evil deity? We will never know its exact purpose, but what is true is that for millennia, humanity has been consumed by a fascination with the other, from man flesh-eating cyclopes to glowing-eyed chupacabra, and even to Cropsey. Humans have always fought a battle with the dark, with themselves, and not always won. Even in suburbia, evil rears its ugly head. Woking, a commuter town nestled deep in Surrey's green hills, is a pleasant place to spend an afternoon, with abundant opportunities to eat, shop, and while away the time on a beautiful autumn's day. It is foremost known as the birthplace of H.G. Wells, and the setting for the War of the Worlds.
In this podcast, we'll be delving into unbelievable instances of myths, monsters, and murders.
Drown Town. The watercourses around Woking have long been instrumental in its growth. From fishing to canal boats, they have been the lifeblood of mercantilism for hundreds of years. But nature cannot always be easily suborned, and sometimes it demands a sacrifice. In the summer of 1865, three young children below the age of 12 lost their lives in Woking's waterways. But three in the space of a fortnight is suspicious. The first was almost certainly death by misadventure, a child falling into the lake at Goldsworth whilst picking flowers on the bank. A loss that was keenly felt and, whilst utterly avoidable, the pain is no less sharp by being confronted with blunt reality.
The second, Mary Ann Norwich, overbalanced by the canal whilst with a group of friends. There are no reports of these friends diving in or attempting to help in any way. She was dragged out with a rake, still breathing, by a man named Howard, whilst another, Mr. Donald, rowed for the prison surgeon.
On his return with the surgeon, Mary Norwich was found to no longer draw breath. Did Howard kill her? Was Mary pushed? We sadly will never know. The last case, and certainly the most inexplicable, involves a vivacious six-year-old, William Collier. On the day in question, his father was mowing the lawn, and William, trying to be helpful, brought his father lunch. Task complete, William played for a while, and then disappeared from sight. It was the last time he would be seen alive. Little William was found drowned near Hoebridge, and an inquest into his death found that it was impossible for him to have got into the water on his own. The case was closed, and no killer was caught. Losing your head over love. No one knows when it will strike. Its symptoms are sweaty palms, impulse decisions, mood swings, and heart palpitations. It can be transmitted by physical contact with other humans, and if left untreated, can lead to death. Do you have it? You might be forgiven for thinking we are describing toxoplasmosis, a parasitic infection caught from cats, or tuberculosis, but the symptoms above describe an altogether different ailment, that of lovesickness.
On the 3rd of December 1881, at 7 a.m, the decapitated body of a deceased male was found beside Woking Railway, and in his hands was clutched a photograph. Webbel, the man who discovered his body, immediately raised the hue and cry, and an investigation was conducted. Upon further examination, a slip of paper was found in his pocket with the words, "This is the girl I die for," written on the front, and the deceased's name and address written on the back. G. E. Moore, a 19-year-old soldier absent for his regiment without permission. He had absconded to his father's residence in Chichester. The father, wanting to help his son, took him back as far as Woking, where they stayed at the Albion Hotel, ready to finish the journey the next day to Aldershot.
That night, the son said he was leaving temporarily, but never returned. It is likely that he jumped in front of the last train to Guildford, severing his head but retaining the photograph in his hand. The disconsolate father later recalled his son writing on the slip of paper, but had no idea it would be a message of death. Low spirits. Woking's convict invalid prison had long since been a source of discomfort for locals. Up until its destruction in the 1970s, its austere walls and towers kept silent sentinel over the town of Knapp Hill. For a time, it held some of Britain's most notorious inmates, from zealous Fenians to cutthroat murderers. Woking was in every way a real slice of rotten Victorian society. The White Woman is the most famous apparition.
Paddy Nolan, having worked at the prison for 40 years, related tales from soldiers who were once barracked there and who saw this female spectre in the clock tower. Allegedly, she was hung. However, we found no instances of an execution at this prison. Paddy also related an instance of a prisoner in 1924 being locked in a silent cell, a padded prison within a prison, and after a fortnight was begging to be released. The inference was that he'd seen something terrifying and otherworldly. There is an image also of an alleged execution area, which shows what paranormal fanatics refer to as an orb, that is to say, some floating remnant of the unhappily deceased.
Nor were the hauntings confined to the prison during active service, as Corinne Garstang, inhabitant of the officers' quarters, which became housing, related three tales of haunting. The first instance is innocent enough. Corinne, alone in the bedroom, heard a distant man's voice say, "Hello." The second haunting also involved her father, who was washing dishes when he heard a woman's voice also say hello. He states that this was close at hand, and almost as if the person were in the room with him. He too was alone in the house. The last, and perhaps strangest, involves her then boyfriend. He was in the garden pottering about when he saw a shadowy figure at the window of the bedroom. The bedroom where Corinne had heard the man's voice. Upon entering the room, he saw nothing. He too was alone. Or was he? Starved of attention. The final tale of Woking's terrible past concerns beings not of ghostly disposition, nor indeed of phantasmagorical proportions, but are monsters too terrifying for being all too real. This tale of twisted depravity, of a mother willfully starved by her son, truly plumbs the depths of immorality. Elizabeth Pitcher was an 85-year-old woman possessed of three cottages in Swaffham, Norfolk, with tenants and an annuity from her grandson for certain fixtures. By all accounts, she should have been living comfortably off of the proceeds of rents, and indeed, she was for a time. 6 weeks prior to the events, she was described as being of tolerably hale appearance. 6 weeks after, a bag of bones with a plague of lice and vermin. For a time, her son John Pitcher, a 45-year-old farmer, had been ill-using her, taking her money, punching her, and denying her the means of subsistence. On one occasion, such was her hunger that she left her house to beg for meat from her tenant, only to be told that he had already paid the rent. Rent money she never saw. On another occasion, her son saw her enter the tenant's house and, overhearing her begging, threatened the tenant and his wife, before dragging his mother outside, cursing her, and hit her so hard in the mouth that she fell to the ground. The monies due to her also from her grandson were taken by John, or by his family, who were cowed, coerced, and did his bidding to avoid his wrath. Elizabeth told her grandson to stop paying as she was not receiving the money. We can't even imagine how John reacted to that. But undeterred, the grandson visited her, fed her, and arranged for her to be removed to the care of her illegitimate son, who who would have gladly taken her in. But John would not allow it, claiming that he was the master of the house. No rescue would take place. By now, John had sole charge of his mother, and so reduced, so pained and alone was she, that she was overheard to remark, "Well, John may as well murder me at once." The neighbours, despite threats to their own personal safety, conveyed their concerns to the police, who duly sent over an officer. He saw the mother alone, unfed, unclothed, and cold, and yet could not intervene, as she, in fear of her life, or to protect her son, even then exclaimed, "Oh no, John has always been kind to me, haven't you, John?" The policeman gave John a warning and left. He was not even gone before the woman was threatened and mistreated once more. By now, Elizabeth did not leave the house and was a prisoner in her own home. Time passed without the neighbours seeing her, and alarmed, they sent for the police once more. When the officer entered, his first thought was that she was dead, laying emaciated on a filthy mattress, her dignity covered by only two pieces of dirty linen. The officer noticed the pillow stuffed in her mouth, as if she had tried to eat it. On closer inspection, this poor creature seemed to be breathing, and, in a voice scarce above a whisper, said, "Give me food." A surgeon was sent for, and declaimed that she must immediately be taken to the infirmary at the local workhouse. Lice were removed, and now clean, they fed her cheese and bread and brandy and butter and water. But nothing could sate her hunger. She had passed the point of no return. 8 days later, she died. When John found out that the policeman had removed his mother, he threatened his own children for not stopping him, and vowed to end the officer's life. For his crimes, John was sentenced to life in prison, and, during sentencing, the judge, knowing full well it would not affect his indifference or elicit feelings of remorse, did so as a warning to all who would shirk their sacred duties to their elderly parents. John ended up serving part of his sentence in the Woking Convict Invalid Prison, and died behind bars. So there we have it, the myths, miseries and mysteries of Woking and its surrounds, where behind every suburb, each hedgerow and manicured lawn, there hides in plain sight instances of the incongruous and inexplicable. We hope you've enjoyed this podcast, and hope you don't have nightmares.